Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello, good afternoon. Welcome along. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon, the show that generally brings together Christians and non-Christians for discussion and debate. I'm back from my summer break, and I hope if you've been away, you've enjoyed it. So, of course, we've still been bringing you regular editions of Unbelievable throughout the summer, and we're going to be hearing some of your contributions to that, some of your reflections on recent editions of the show at the end of today's programme. Don't forget, though, that Unbelievable is part of Faith Explored every Saturday afternoon, brought to you in association with Premier Christianity Magazine. If you want to find out more about that, I'm the senior editor, and some of the great articles and how you can get a free copy of the magazine, just go to premierchristianity.com. And if you want more about the show, today's guests, and everything else, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable for the Unbelievable show page. So what have we got coming up for you today? It's a discussion on a rather familiar sounding topic. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the programme, is belief in God all in the mind? Graham Ward joins me. He's the Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford University, and he's got a new book out called Unbelievable, to coin a phrase, Why We Believe and Why We Don't. It's about the science and psychology of believing and whether consciousness and the brain can be explained in purely naturalistic terms. Part of the description of the book says, though the truth of belief remains under increasing attack in a thoroughly secularized context, Ward boldly argues that secularity is itself a form of believing. Well, on the line today, joining this conversation is Sue Blackmore. She's a freelance writer, lecturer and broadcaster and visiting professor at the University of Plymouth. She is, of course, an atheist. She's been on the show in the past. She's written and researched in the area of consciousness, of course, including her most recent book, Zen and the Art of Consciousness. And so we'll make sure there are links to both my guests who are joining me on the programme today. But first of all, thank you very much, Graham, for coming on the programme.
That's fine.
It's great.
That's fine.
Great to have you in today. We've had your predecessor on the programme, another Ward.
Often mistaken for my father, but yeah. He's not.
is there some kind of special thing where you have to share the surname Ward to be Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford?
Not quite. It just is one of those coincidences that I have always trailed behind Keith and his son. At Cambridge reading theology at the same time as Keith's son, so we were even confused then.
There you go. For those who aren't familiar with what this post entails, it's sort of officially appointed by the Queen, isn't it, the Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford?
Yeah, as in it goes through the Prime Minister's office, and it's part of a commission that is then set up in the Patronage Commission. So formally she has to sign at the end to agree to what the committee and the Patronage Commission have actually decided. It has been known apparently for her to say no. But maybe that's itself a myth, I don't know.
In any case, what does your typical day look like? I think it does involve actually being part of a worshipping community as much as doing the academic theological stuff.
Well, the post is related to the cathedral, Christ Church, Oxford's cathedral. So I'm a canon of the cathedral. So it begins with morning prayer just after seven, and then goes through to communion, morning communion. And then really the rest of the day, I don't have duties within the cathedral as such over the rest of the day. Most of my duties are all then with the university. Mm. And that's mainly I've got a large group of research students who I work with, and then there's lecturing and seminar giving and things.
And do you sort of have a fairly free hand as to what subjects you want to research and write about and that kind of thing?
Well, I do enjoy the fact that my title is the Professor of Divinity. Mm. That gives me a lot of scope for what I do, because I do a lot on the nature of religion rather than necessarily Christian theology. And also, you know, my grandchildren and one of my children are Muslim. So, in fact, the Christian theology always has in the background that, in fact, there are other faiths out there. And so that enables me to raise all sorts of questions then to do with, well, what is the relationship between these forms of religious piety and Christian faith, for example?
It's a bit outside the remit of what we're going to be talking about on today's programme, but I know that you're also part of what's come to be termed the sort of radical orthodoxy movement. Do you, could you kind of encapsulate what that is in a nutshell?
In a nutshell, it's not a movement.
No. I mean,
so I am, you know, you could get other people who are associated with it that would be more hardline. I'm the soft belly of whatever radical orthodoxy is. There is a shared sensibility and a shared sensibility that we want to talk about the relationship between Christian theology and the nature of participation in God and what that would actually involve. But the radical orthodoxy as a title was just pure serendipity. That was a marketing thing created by Routledge when we all sat round wanting to give a book series a title. And for all intents and purposes, when anyone says radical orthodoxy, we usually say, okay, what do you think you mean by that? Because what I think I mean are the 10 or so books that were published in the series before it closed out.
Sure. Let's talk about your latest book. And this is just been released, literally, as we speak. It's called Unbelievable. I'm glad you chose the title of the programme that you're appearing on.
I didn't even know this was the title.
But it's a happy coincidence, but the subtitle maybe explains a bit more why we believe and why we don't. Okay, again, in a nutshell, what's the aim of this book? Who's it for?
Well, again, this comes back to why I enjoy talking and writing about religion as well as actually writing about theology, because this is not a book for theologians. It arises from a question from someone who is a French sociologist who raised a question for me a number of years ago, and that question was, what makes a belief believable? Why do we believe what we believe? And he was not particularly interested at that point in religious believing in the article he was writing. It was about political adherence. You know, why do you believe this politician rather than that politician? Why do you believe this situation rather than that situation? And so what he introduced me to, I mean, the writer is called Michel de Certeau. What he introduced me to was that there is a politics about believing and that the nature of believing changes with historical and cultural shifts. And I wanted to examine that, given some of the work that has been done on the psychology of believing and rooting that even in the biology of believing. And towards the end, I raise questions to do with, well, what does religious faith have to do with the nature of believing itself? But it's actually a book that's mainly about the endemic nature of believing, that's what we are as human beings.
Okay, so which is psychological, biological, which is
anthropological.
Yeah.
And so I trace that kind of believing as it works within fiction, for instance, poetic faith, the suspension of disbelief, or the way it works within political myths,
yeah,
and why we believe certain things, you know, about certain political parties or whatever.
Sue, thank you very much for joining us on the line as well. Be good for those who can't cast their mind back to when you last joined me on the programme some time ago. To get a sense,
while ago, yeah.
It was a long time ago. Tell us about your introduction to the whole area of the brain, believing, consciousness, and that kind of thing.
Well, I went through almost extraordinary changes in what I believed in, intellectually, academically, and religiously. I think I gave up my religious belief several times as a child and got it back and then gave it up again. But the really big change came when I was a student in Oxford in 1970, and I had a very dramatic out-of-the-body experience. Now, in 1970, we didn't have any understanding at all of what was going on in the brain. Now, with all the brain scans we have and MRI and PET scans and all the other research that we've done on development and other things, we understand extremely well how out-of-body experiences are created, in which parts of the brain have to be stimulated for them to occur, and exactly what's going on. We didn't know any of that in 1970. Mm. And I had this extraordinary experience in which I was looking down from the ceiling, and everything was as real, more real than anything in ordinary life. And it felt so absolutely right. So exactly, this is it. You know, ordinary life is a shadow compared to this. And I began rather trivially as an out-of-body experience, flying around Oxford having fun. But to cut a very long story short, because it lasted more than 2 hours, it ended up in a classic mystical experience of oneness. I became very small into nothing. I became very big into everything. And myself simply was no more. And I've had other mystical experiences before and since, but not of that depth and stability. And it just was obvious to me that we are all one, this is how it is, and that ordinary life is a kind of false separation of myself from, you know, something of that kind. At oneness. The more silly it sounds, because if you've had that experience, you know what I'm talking about, and if you haven't, it sounds a bit dark.
And it's made all the more evocative with the sound of the swishing of the sea in the background.
But... yes, I'm sitting on my kayak, taking a brief rest on a beach while I'm giving my grandson a kayak lesson. Sorry about that.
No, it's
anyway,
great. It's great.
What happened then was I became completely convinced that the consciousness was separate from the body, that it would survive death, that telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition, all those things must be true. I mean, I jumped to all these conclusions, and I decided to devote my life to becoming a parapsychologist and proving to all the scientific closed-minded people, as I saw it then, that they were wrong and that there's more in heaven and earth and all that.
Mm.
And it took me many years' research. I finished my degree in psychology and physiology and learned a lot about the brain, what was known then. And then I did years and years of research, and I did a PhD on telepathy and clairvoyance and things, and then I went back to studying out-of-body experiences. And that process taught me, as sure as I can be, which isn't 100%, that there are no paranormal phenomena, that there are far better explanations for these experiences, and so I had to change my beliefs. That's painful. When you're really committed to some belief, like, I'm absolutely sure I've left my body, to then have to say, oh, actually, I was wrong. I can now understand why the thing feels so wonderfully real and everything without having all these supernatural things. And I gave up that belief and have had a wonderful life studying the mind and the brain and consciousness and all of that.
And convinced now, from all that you've read and researched, that it is a purely physical process by which we have these experiences.
Yes, I am convinced of that, in the sense that we now understand how out-of-body experiences occur. We can cause them. It's quite difficult to do. You have to have someone having brain surgery, but there's a certain place you can stimulate the temporoparietal junction, which is the area of the brain that constructs our body image and our self-image. And when that is disturbed in some way, when you're coming close to death, when you're very frightened, or under other circumstances with certain drugs, for example, even on the verge of sleep, then an out-of-body experience can take place, which is basically a distortion of your body image. So that, I would say, yes. But there are mysteries galore. I mean, how can a physical brain made of neurons pumping chemicals backwards and forwards and electrical signals going up and down, how can that be related to, I'm using a neutral phrase here, be related to this conscious experience? I'm looking at this beautiful blue sea and sky and the puffy clouds and the waves. That experience of mine, which is unique to me, ineffable, how can that be because of my brain?
Mm.
Now, that is a mystery for science, and I wouldn't pretend I can even get close to it. I don't know how to solve it at all, other than to say the natural way of thinking, which seems to come very early in childhood, and there's lots of research, I think you referred to it earlier on, there's lots of research on development in children now, which shows that very early on, they separate mind from body. They think of people as having minds and controlling their bodies. They think of animate things as having minds and not inanimate things. Now, that happens very early.
Mm.
Have this dualistic view of the world. There's mind and there's matter. There's me and there's the experiences. There's a physical beach and there's my experience of the beach. We just do that dualism.
Yeah.
Only way to understand the world is really without dualism, with monism, and that's the difficult thing that we can't.
Because it seems to go against our natural inclination, what we're almost born with. This comes up in the book to some extent, does it, Graham?
It does, because in fact, I'm not wanting to pursue a dualism of any kind between either mind and brain or mind and body. I want to see the correlation between the two. And I also would just, again, reiterate what Sue said. I mean, there is still a lot we don't understand about the generation of consciousness from the nature of the brain and our the biology and physiology of being human. And that's really what kind of prompted me to want to look into this at all kinds of levels. I mean, some of the most there's a massive debate that's still going on between people in cognitive science and neuroscience about whether, in fact, the mind is an epiphenomena, it's something that's created out of the biological, or whether it's something really quite distinct. I mean, from Raymond Tallis and Thomas Nagel all the way down to people against that, Daniel Dennett, for example. What I want to kind of explore is the way in which, as embodied creatures, we are constantly living with that which is invisible, like thought, like imagination, and that we are negotiating a whole life with things that are not apparent. I mean, even, you know, with the brain scans that we have, the brain scans are not mapping our thoughts as such. What they're actually mapping is, you know, blood and oxygen as it travels through various parts of the brain and things. So in fact, again, what we're having to do is infer that this brain activity is thinking or activation or whatever. But while wanting then to not buy into that dualism, wanting to actually say there is still something that's mysterious. I mean, some biologists like Terry Deacon will, you know, want to talk about emergence and that there is some biological way in which out of the physiological, something which is called the conceptual emerges in some way we don't quite know at the moment, but in the same way that stardust turns to organic nature. And
in your view, Sue, you're familiar with all of these concepts and so on, but there is ultimately always going to be a physical baseline explanation for all these things in your view.
Well, I, the one thing I would say is there's going to be one stuff. And I think we agree here. Dualism has to go. Whether that will end up being something we call physical or material, I don't know. I think we're so confused at the moment. But I want to tackle there the idea that the two options are one, correlation or emergence or something, and the other is something truly separate, that the soul or the mind or consciousness is something truly separate. There is also the idea that there's no separation. And even the idea of correlation or emergence is a kind of dualism, different from Cartesian dualism, but it's still a kind of, well, this other thing emerges from the physical brain. I think we're going to find in the end that it's not like that, that somehow we will understand in a way that is completely impossible to understand at the moment and very mysterious, that mind simply is brain, or that, not perhaps brain, but what the brain does, that thoughts simply are that activity. Now, that seems really hard to take on now, but think of something like we're quite happy to accept that light is electromagnetic radiation, even though most of us can't really understand the physics. as time goes by, we get used to that idea. I think it's possible that we will get used to the idea that, that mind is just the activity going on in the brain, and then we would drop all the dualism. But I can't see how. That's the way I think it's going to go. But, you know, I might be completely wrong and something will happen that I'll go, oh, no, of course, that's what solves the problem. But I can't see it at the moment.
Is that the way it's going as far as you're concerned, though, Graham?
Well, in some sense, yes. I mean, it does seem to me, I'm just recalling a conversation I had with Raymond Tallis, who's in neuroscience. And Raymond, who again is not a Christian at all, in fact has no religious belief, will just say we need a better understanding of what materiality is. We don't have it at the moment. And he, you know, tries to pursue that through quantum physics, which actually wants to bring together both the physical and the mental as being in some way cooperative with each other. All I am trying to do is actually look at the way, in that mysteriousness of what's going on, believing issues, and issues as quite a natural phenomena in all human beings.
And believing specifically, say, in an invisible entity like God.
No, that's not where I actually want to start. I want to, you know, if you look at the nature of believing's not, it's not pure cognition, because in fact a lot of us believe inchoately in things. We don't.
What do you mean inchoately?
That we can't fully articulate.
Yes.
What we're actually believing. And it's more amorphous, it shifts and it changes. But believing is not an emotion either, though it is related very closely. I mean, we know, for example, how positive believing can actually affect physiological feeling, sure, can affect mood, can affect all kinds of things. So in fact, what I want to look at is that the nature of where that, if you like, that primordial disposition, which has to be biological and physiological, as well as eventually becoming cognitive, and how that also can be manipulated, which is about the politics of believing. So you can be persuaded that this is believable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, you are listening to Unbelievable, and if you want to get in touch about anything you hear on today's programme, all the usual methods, you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and we'll be hearing some of your email messages later on today. You can tweet, you can Facebook at UnbelievableJB, find us on Facebook at facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. And of course, you can find all those links at the website of Unbelievable, the brand new one. But the marvellous thing about the new website is that when you go to specific shows, you can now comment on the shows underneath those specific shows. So if you haven't done that yet, why not try that out as well? PremierChristianRadio.com/Unbelievable. So if you're listening online, you can go to today's edition of the programme and leave your comment below the programme, and I'll be picking those up as well in due course. So lots to think about today on the programme. I'm joined by Graham Ward, the Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford University, talking about his new book, Unbelievable, about the biology of belief and the brain and so on. And of course, we've been hearing from Sue Blackmore. Now, Sue, I know you can't stay with us for much longer, just for time constraints. But before you go, what would be your response to this idea that somehow it ultimately we are kind of constantly in touch with this invisible realm that somehow suffuses life at some level?
Well, I think the whole idea about what's invisible is fascinating. I did a World Service program recently all about invisibility. In a sense, thoughts are invisible to us. What is thought? This is just such a very difficult thing. And I agree with Graham entirely that believing is not just one kind of thing. It's not just, I believe in God as a kind of statement. It actually goes deep down into the way we behave, the way we relate to others, and so on. I think the interesting thing that's happened in my lifetime is all the research that's now going on how we develop beliefs and how children come to have them and what things are believable, because we believe something when it fits in some way into everything else we believe. It's very hard to take on a belief that doesn't relate to anything else we believe. And so if you start out with being brought up in a particular religion, it's awfully hard then to switch. If you're brought up in a certain kind of world where things work in a certain way, it's very difficult to believe in other kinds of things. Simple physics that you take on, folk physics that you kind of pick up from throwing things around as a kid, you know, then that has to be developed into something else. And all, I mean, belief covers all of these things. So I look forward to reading the book, and I'm very sorry I can't carry on discussing it any further today.
Thanks, Sue. Cheers. Yes, so Sue Blackmore, only able to join us for a little bit of today's programme to just start off the conversation, really, on the whole aspect of believing and the psychology of it, the biology of it and everything else. And so what we'll do with the rest of our time together, Graeme, is just sort of talk through some of the other issues that arise in the book. I mean, in a sense, something that strikes me, though, from just what Sue was saying there is this question of, well, Is the science kind of gradually just saying more and more of it simply shows that it's dependent on the brain, on the physics of the brain, the biology of the brain? And are Christians, when they come along with, you know, and start interacting with theories of consciousness and so on, just looking for ways to sort of sneak a sort of metaphysical nature to all of this into the equation, but end up labelling it, as Sue has, mysterious in some level?
No, I don't think so. I mean, again, Sue seems to still accept that the mind is something that's produced by the brain. And I think that we don't know that because we don't know that relationship to it. Mm. I mean, one of the other possibilities that is being investigated, and it's being investigated by some philosophers of biology, for example, like Terence Deakin, like Michael Ruse, which is, and like David Papineau as well here in London, which is that there are even at the cellular level proto-mentalities. So, for example, when you prod a cell, It actually withdraws and moves in a different direction. In other words, there is in biology a sense at the moment that there is a kind of teleology, a purposefulness, that there are dispositions, if you like, towards which, and that they are to do with human flourishing. They're to do with holding on to life and avoiding breaking the boundaries of that in any particular way. So you have got some biologists, and I've talked to some of these because there are a number of them. Oxford is quite a place for molecular biology and study molecular biology and epigenetics at the moment. And I've talked to them because they will often want to talk about the cell having intention, which is a rather interesting word to actually use. Now, obviously, you know, I'm interested in, you know, is that a metaphor?
Yeah.
Or is that a piece of anthropomorphism? Mm. And it's that kind of question. I mean, a number of them who, you know, accept a more blind kind of we're going nowhere, and
there's no ultimate goal.
Yeah, there's no ultimate goal for anything. You know, there were just some to say, no, it's a metaphor. And you know, I accept that that's what they, the evidence that they have and the frameworks within which they're seeing it, that will apply. But there are others who are saying, well, we can't say that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we can make that as a hypothesis, but we can't demonstrate.
Yeah, yeah. That. It can't be demonstrated that there is no overarching
That's right. That's right. And if you like, my interest in believing goes back to then that kind of move forward, that dispositional aspect that's rooted in our biologies, then becomes dispositional in some of the deeper biological and psychological things to do with belief, hope, desire. All these are dispositional states.
Yeah.
But they have, they're physiological, but they have also mental and conceptual constructions that can be put upon them.
We're going to take a short break and we'll be back talking more about the book. Something more of a one-to-one conversation between myself and Graeme Ward, my guest on today's programme. Come back in a moment's time. We're talking about belief in, well, anything really, but also how it touches on belief in the supernatural and the mind on today's programme, looking at Graeme Ward's new book, Unbelievable, Why We Believe and Why why we don't. And you're listening to Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon and online, of course, at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Do join us again in a few moments' time.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories, tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
In the September edition, we hear from megachurch pastor Charlotte Gamble on family, women's ministry, and on leading Life Church Bradford. Find out what happened when Markstein Adamson befriended homeless drug addict Alan Dainton and the extraordinary photos that followed. Plus, an essential guide to theology testing your worship songs. All this, plus news, reviews, and your favourite columnists.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit christianitymagazine.co.uk/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And I'm Justin Brierley, presenting the programme, and part of your regular diet of material for thinking Christians on a Saturday afternoon, Faith Explored, hosted by myself, Unbelievable, a key part of that, and Unbelievable, the title of a new book by Graham Ward, who is my guest on today's programme. Graham is the Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford University. His new book is called Unbelievable, Why We Believe and Why We Don't, and we were talking alongside Sue Blackmore, who's an atheist and, if you like, a materialist with respect to the way the brain works and our mind and consciousness and so on. But those are all things that Graham tackles in this book. And if you want to pick it up, I'll make sure there's a link to the Amazon account for it online. If you go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable for today's show and the links to my guest today, Graham. And of course, that's the place to go if you want to find out more about various other things, past shows, the Unbelievable Conference DVD and audio CD, and much more besides. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. So I've got you in sort of just really to pick your brain now on this book, Graham. But we do have this coincidence of my programme title and your book, which is what made me want to get in touch with you about it, actually, that called Unbelievable. Why did you call a book about belief Unbelievable?
I could ask the same of you, so you're going to have to come back to me on that one. Because it starts and finishes with two stories that remain inexplicable to me, and that most people would actually see as being stories in which belief was tested. Mm. The first one occurred several years ago now, when I was Dean of Peterhouse in Cambridge. And one November evening, when we were down having supper in hall, the butler came to me and said, "Could I come immediately?" Now, this is a formal dinner on high table. You don't kind of leave the hall without actually it really being very, very important.
Okay.
Furthermore, the master was in charge, and the master and I had a very difficult relationship.
Okay.
So I really kind of said to Mark, who was a butler at that time, this is really going to be difficult. And he said, "You've got to come." Mm-hmm. So I eventually did go, and I went into the next room adjoining the hall, and there was just a mass of china all over the floor, and the room felt preternaturally cold, and two of the staff who were serving were just sitting down in chairs with their heads in their hands, and they couldn't even speak to me at all. And I said to Mark, what has happened?
Mm.
And he said, "Well, they saw a figure, and the figure just moved across the room and then disappeared."
And the smashed crockery?
That was their fright.
Right, they dropped the things they were carrying.
They dropped everything they were carrying when they saw this thing. So this rapidly became, it was near Christmas. The BBC took it up as a big story.
Okay.
It went around
Reuters
about the Peterhouse ghost. And, I was being interviewed and all sorts of things. And I found myself just kind of I didn't know what to make of it. You know, I'm a Christian theologian. I don't believe in kind of, I believe in the resurrection of the body. So that meant, you know, what's
but
this
where's
ghost
the category
bit?
For, yes,
yeah,
apparitions
and things. I had no categories for ghosts. Mm. I didn't know where these... No, I went to, had to go to the bishop because, in fact, there were several people that were ringing in saying they would come and exorcise the ghosts. I went to the bishop and said, I don't even know how to go about that. So, but we do have a diocesan exorcist that can come in and do something if you want. And I said, but I have a deeper question. How does this relate to anything I believe?
Yeah.
And he didn't know. And I went to a Dominican friend of mine and, you know, I said the same thing to him. And he said, well, I don't know. All I can tell you is that we have a room upstairs in the priory that we don't allow anyone to stay in because there's something malicious in there.
Right, goodness.
So that didn't help either. but it generated within the college a whole lot of kind of questions.
Yeah.
Some who believed that this was a ghost. Mm. Some who would find out and made kind of examinations of the plumbing and the electricity and they
came up with some natural explanation for this phenomenon.
What interested me about what went on was not the explanations they were coming up with. Some of them wouldn't even go past the room at night because they were really... Mm. It was the emotions it generated. It was something more than cognitive. The explanations were being generated because they were emotionally trying to cope with something that was disruptive and that didn't fit into the normal everyday life. So it was from there that I began, this is not about interpreting natural phenomena in the world and coming up with explanations or not. This is about the way in which things are rooted in our prior understandings of things, how we've come to understand things, why we come to understand things in certain ways. In other words, rooted back in those dispositions of desire and hope and believing.
I get to interview a lot of believers and non-believers on this programme. What's evident to me very often is that very often an atheist who comes on says, I'm just not predisposed to believe. Some people have talked about sort of almost not being tuned in on the same wavelength that the Christian guest is evidently tuned in on or something, or saying I'm sort of tone deaf to religion. I mean, do you get the sense from what you've been doing in the book that there's an aspect of that some people sort of are just predisposed to believe, others simply predisposed not to believe when it comes to the supernatural, for instance?
Well, I think we're all disposed at some level. Because the nature of believing, let's take it at the very basic level. We don't just see things, we see things as things, which means that we're constantly seeing them within frameworks of beliefs that we actually have. I mean, take that on a kind of cultural level. I mean, in the, I think it was 1950s, 1960s, Time magazine ran a whole thing about a survey on belief in angels. There was actually quite a surprising level of belief in angels in America at that particular time. I think it was between 40 and 50%, but I'm kind of getting the figures out of nowhere at the moment. What is interesting is that they did this in 1995, 1996, because Hillary Clinton claimed that this was the year of the angel, and she had a Christmas tree just made with angels. There were a lot of films coming out about angels at the time. There was Angels in America, a great Broadway hit that was coming out at that time. Time magazine ran this survey again. The phenomenal rise of those that actually believed in angels and the phenomenal rise of publications on angels, had risen, quite astonishingly. Yeah. So that's a kind of cultural change. Something that was off the map at one time suddenly becomes on the map.
Yeah.
Part of the book is trying to actually say is where we are now is we are in a particular culture in which believing is valued. Mm. So if you look at things like Sony, make believe, or even Justin Bieber's album, Believe. Yeah. Belief is high on the agenda. It was part of the Olympic team, British Olympic team
motto.
Logo.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Believe in better.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
right to the Odeon kind of leave reality at home. Believing is very, very high on the agenda. The number of books coming out on belief at the moment are really, and the kind of work being done by philosophers like Tim Crane, etc., about believing. There's a lot of work going on now. A number of philosophers want to talk about soft knowledge. In other words, that whole kind of structure of positivism, empiricism, knowledge is this, it's all facts, and it's all, that's gone. And we're entering a culture in which things are much more amorphous. We're entering a kind of Transformers culture, if you like. A toaster can become a killing machine. It just needs the right kind of mechanism.
That's really interesting. I do wonder, because obviously, again, in relation to this programme, very often the call of the new atheism and some of the hardline materialists is, well, we can only believe what we see via the scientific method evidence. It's sort of going back to that empiricist, rationalist sort of view. But from what you're saying, it sounds like even people who are coming at it thinking, I've got this objective, you know, science only, evidence only sort of based thing. No, there's all kinds of other things actually in the background that will be informing actually what you do.
There are all kinds of other things. Again, they are seeing as. They're not just seeing. Mm. Empirical information is not just information like that. It's been interpreted. I mean, there are a number of philosophers of science that show that it gets interpreted in certain ways. But I think, you know, let's come back to that new atheism, because I find it absolutely fascinating. What is it about that new atheism which is actually pulling it into the best-selling list? It's the style in which they write. They've got a visceral and a real viral style. Now, that to me, that style to me, says that there's something going on way, way deeper than actually what's going on cognitively. Okay. There's a real emotional kind of being generated here. And so I want to investigate whether, in fact, what's that emotion about? What's that reaction about that's creating this kind of very energetic and polemical style? I mean, people have been, you know, doing this kind of atheist stuff philosophically for a number of years. James Mackey, for instance, very kind. But, I mean, it's not read outside of, you know, basically philosophy. This is read by lots of, but they're queuing into the emotion, they're queuing into the polemic, and I want to know what that's about. I have a sense that what they're doing on the surface in terms of their arguments is really quite superficial. It's what's going on underneath that I really would like to get at.
Yeah. I mean, you said yourself, as a Christian theologian, you believe, you said, in the resurrection of the body, for instance. Now, do you believe in that on the basis of any particular evidence? Is it an encounter, an experience that you're believing on the basis of? Can you even probably list the things that would lead you to hold that belief, because many of them may be unconscious in some way? I mean, what sort of makes you reasonably certain about the belief you hold there, whereas someone like we had Sue on earlier on would say, no, don't be daft, they've absolutely no reason to be believing that kind of thing. So how would you kind of approach those kinds of beliefs which are quite sort of unique to Christian belief?
Well, if you accept, towards the end of the book, I try and get on to this. If you accept that we are anthropologically kind of hardwired for believing, and then it goes all the way down, then in many ways, what is also interesting is that from the earliest understanding of what we know about those forms of human being, or those forms of hominid that came before humans, all of them had a religious kind of culture and a cultural sense. So you kind of think, well, then somehow all the evidence that we have from anthropology and suggests that disposition to believe was interpreted religiously even before Homo sapiens were actually around. That was understood. So there is a sense in which you could almost say then there you could accept the fact that we believe, and then say, on the basis of that belief, what then do I consciously want to commit myself to believing. And if you look at the Christian theology or my own personal story with Christian, I understand Christian theology in terms of faith seeking understanding. Mm. So there was a time when I accepted things on faith basis. I wasn't inquiring into. I wasn't looking for the evidence. When you come to that understanding, and remember, within the Christian tradition, then things like faith are given. They're revealed to you. It's not just simply a natural disposition. Sure. So there comes a point in which, if you like, there is a believing. You know, there's the account in the Gospels where Jesus is confronted and says, you know, about believing, and the man answers, "I believe, help thou my unbelief." Mm. You know, and I see that as really quite a very perceptive moment. Mm. So you believe. So what do I believe? And then there is, you know, I believe that then there is another movement, which is the operation of God in terms of the operation of the Spirit within the world, in which God's self is revealed. And there came a time when, for me, that became something that was very real. Mm. And that, if you like, you can call that a conversion, or I accepted Christ, or whatever. But at that point, you know, what other than I accepted Jesus as Lord, if you like, I didn't know that much.
Mm. No, indeed.
I went along to my group at my church and was part of the church, and you grow into the understanding of what you believe. But you're not looking for evidence. So if you're coming back to your question, I don't look for evidence for the resurrection of the body. More than in a way, I do believe that Scripture is revealed to us. I believe that's the basis upon which it is holy and a sacred Scripture. And that speaks about Jesus being resurrected from the dead. And it speaks about that being the first fruits, where we will be resurrected from the dead. And there's a verse in Romans that Paul uses, which I think is really interesting, is that in between Jesus' resurrection and the final resurrection, there is not only creation groaning, but we groan, and Paul says, for the redemption of our bodies. Mm. Now, where I look, if you like, for the evidence is recognizing that is something that we all want.
An experience,
That redemption of the body. We want that. We are aware of what we don't have.
Yeah. And this kind of, as it were, maybe that takes a solid shape in the Christian story and tradition, has kind of been, at some level, hinted at in, you know, our evolutionary history, let's say, and so we've had this disposition to believe, to have a kind of supernatural agency and so on.
Yeah.
I mean, but of course now you've got people like Daniel Dennett, and in fact I did try and see if he could come on to have the dialogue with you today, but he wasn't available.
Dan would do that.
But I don't know, it would have been interesting. But so he wrote the book Breaking the Spell, and then that the whole point of that was to say, well, whatever, you know, these, you know, tendencies we've had to believe in the supernatural, we can explain it all now.
But he can't. That's the whole... I mean, what he does, take that book Explaining Consciousness, which is, it doesn't explain it at all. You get rid of the, you know, the Cartesian little man who's controlling everything. And what do you get in its place? You get 101 demons in pandemonia with neurotransmitters, kind of, you know... So that's not an explanation. And this comes back to that invisibility thing. He's not seeing this. He's inferring this.
Sure.
So he's seeing as, which means that he's already working it within a certain construct that he's actually got. And what I want to do is say, look, I don't mind if you want to call that explanation, but that's explanation of what you believe. Yeah. It's not an explanation of what you know.
So basically it's taking what an a priori assumption about the nature of our reality and saying, well, this explains it.
Yeah.
Whereas in fact...
Yeah.
I mean, but I mean, many people like Dennett would point out the ways in which, and Sue, I think, alluded to this as well, what we do know about the brain has allowed us to have explanations. So when we plod this bit, it makes you feel happy or sad, yeah, or have an experience. You know, someone who's involved in an accident that damages their brain, their personality may change. And so they'll say, there's your evidence, if you need it, Graham, that we are fundamentally material things.
I'm not denying that. I'm not denying we are material. I mean, in fact, you know, in many ways, the Christian story has one of the most profound accounts of our materiality. Incarnation is absolutely, yes, yes, at the very base of this. Again, I come back to what I said, you know, with Sue. I am not proposing some kind of body-soul dualism here.
Unlike your predecessor, then.
Unlike Keith
Ward, who, as I understand it, is essentially a dualist in terms of the way he sets this up.
Well, I think with Keith, I'd have to talk more to Keith about this. I would think that he was not an ontological dualist, okay, as in that these were two, yeah, completely different. I would think that, you know, he's something, you know, a dualist in the way that maybe Thomas Nagel is a dualist. In other words, it's saying that the mind does seem to be different from,
yeah,
the body,
yeah,
and we can't get away from that difference. Mm. And there is no cause and effect evident between the operation of the brain and consciousness as, yeah, an effect. We, yeah, don't know that. We can, yeah, infer that, which is what, mm, Dennett does. But in fact, we don't know that in any particular way. So I think he is... He would be, again, like Tallis and Nagel, saying, we haven't got a name for what might this be. So, yeah, if you like, it's a soft dualism.
Yeah. But those people who do want to say, well, we're understanding more of the brain. We see the way that what happens in the brain when you poke this bit and that bit and so on. And so we're getting an increasingly physical account of the brain. Do you think that they're actually... not actually moving in that direction, because...
Oh, no, we are. And in fact, we're moving in directions which are even more interesting, because what we've relied on, things like the MRI scans and PET scans and that, these are, in many ways, kind of surface scans, mm, of the brain. And in fact, a lot of the kind of work that's been done in neuroscience, other than the kind of experimental work with people with brain damage, has been actually looking at these. There's a whole kind of debate at the moment in neuroscience about the value of these, because now we've got three-dimensional scanning.
Mm.
And the three-dimensional scanning, one would infer that, in fact, what went on the surface would be replicated by what goes on below. But, in fact, deep scanning doesn't seem to show that at all.
Mm.
That in fact, there doesn't seem to be the same kind of, okay, correlation. So there's a whole kind of... debate at the moment in terms of the status of all this brain scanning and what it has actually shown. Now, that is not to deny the functioning of the brain, but it is to open questions to do with cause and effect between, yeah, brain and consciousness, for example.
A theological question at this point, and, okay, and you may want to say, you know, I don't know, but... I know people who are increasingly turning to what's sometimes called Christian physicalism, which is the view that pretty much agrees with a Sue Blackmore or a Daniel Dennett, almost, to say we are physical creatures. And it's very precisely in the fact that we will be raised physically in Christian doctrine that says that we can't be separated. You know, there isn't a soul which goes off to heaven to be later reunited with our physical body at the time of the resurrection. We are physical, that's the way God made us, and we'll be raised physical. And so we shouldn't try to suggest that there is a soul as such, because humanity is this physical thing.
Right, okay. Well, there's a lot in that. I mean, there are various forms of Christian physicalism. I mean, the one that is... perhaps actually quite influential for me is what's called non-reductive materialism or non-reductive physicalism, which actually opens up questions that it can't, mm, be physical all the way down, because we don't fully know what, mm, the physical and the material is all the way down. And that takes its cue a lot from quantum mechanics. Let's go back to that notion of the soul. Now, yes, if you're looking at the nature of the soul as being something which is separate or separable from embodiment, then there are ways in which that has had a Christian tradition. Although, in terms of Augustine and certainly in terms of Aquinas, you couldn't separate the two, because in fact the soul was the form of the body, and I still actually like that. Mm. You know, in fact, you're not going to be able to separate the two, because just as anything that you encounter in the environment affects you physically, so then it would affect you at other levels which are deeper, which the old tradition would call the soul. So in fact, you know, your abuse as a child physically, that is going to damage something more than just your body.
Sure.
You know, that will damage all sorts of things which, you know, would have been called the soul.
Yeah.
All right. Now, it seems to me that we could redo that language, if you like. Mm-hmm. Though the difficulty is that by the time of Descartes, of course, that was now splitting between the body and the soul as being something separate, which makes my ghosts perfectly understandable if that's the way it is.
Yeah.
But my reaction to it was simply because I don't believe that.
Yeah.
You can't the any notion of the spirit or the soul has got to be very much interrelated.
It's got to be embodied.
Absolutely. But at the same time, in terms of the resurrection, these are really interesting theological questions, because in terms of the resurrection, we're not resurrected necessarily in the same kind of bodies. I mean, Paul talks about a spiritual body. And you know, going back further into the tradition, people like Gregory of Nyssa talked about the resurrection, or Augustine talked about the resurrection. There is a physical aspect about it. So, for example, in Augustine, we are resurrected with our genitals, male and female.
Right. Yeah.
But how we conceive that, I don't think we can conceive in the same way as we conceive physicalism now.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to take another quick break and we'll just wrap up this conversation. My guest today is Graham Ward. He's the Regius Professor of Divinity at the University of Oxford. His latest book is Unbelievable, Why We Believe and Why We Don't. And it's been a fascinating, wide-ranging conversation on consciousness and belief and all kinds of things. Links, of course, to today's programme, to the book and everything else, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Do join us again in a moment's time as we conclude our conversation. Welcome back to the final part of this week's Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Part of Faith Explored every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio. And Faith Explored encompasses lots of different programmes that help you to think through your faith. You can hear after today's programme between 4 and 5 an interview with mega church leader and mum, Charlotte Gamble. She's the leader of Life Church in Bradford, which is a multi-campus church. Lucinda van der Hart, who's the associate editor for Premier Christianity magazine, talks to her about her life and faith there, taking over the church from her dad, and much more besides. And she's actually our lead profile in this month's edition of the magazine, Premier Christianity magazine. So if you want to read that as well, then you can go online and do so at premierchristianity.com. But look out for that between 4 and 5 later on this afternoon. We're going to hear some of your feedback to today's programme as well, of course. Anne has emailed in saying she wishes we would spend more time on the feedback part of the programme. It often sort of is curtailed to about 15 minutes or so. Well, I'm afraid it's going to be a similar sort of amount today. And the reality is, equally get emails from people saying, can't you spend more time talking to the guests instead of reading out the feedback? But we will do some feedback. Also, just a flag up of what's coming up next week on Unbelievable as well. We're going to be speaking to Nick Spencer of Theos. Nick is the author of a new book
called Atheists, The Origin of the Species. It's had some very good reviews, and he's going to be talking to us about it, looking at the history of atheism, some of its different iterations and modern forms. And he's going to be in conversation, we hope, this is yet to be absolutely nailed down, but with Julian Baggini, who's an atheist philosopher and writer, and gave a favourable review of the book, actually, in The Guardian recently. But I'm sure they'll have lots of interesting things to disagree about as well. So look out for that next week. Atheists, The Origin of the Species. Time to get into the final part of my conversation with Graham Ward.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So concluding this conversation, Graham, on the book Unbelievable, one of the things it says that secularity itself could be seen as a form of believing. Just explain that and how this links into what we've been talking about.
The idea that secularity is a form of believing, in fact, more than that, I mean, the idea that I say secularity is a myth, and it's an ideological myth. The way that comes up in a chapter when I deal with the politics of believing and how, particularly the way myth works to convince us that something is the natural normative state. And this is, you know, political theorists have tackled this question in the past. And so I began to look, to what extent are we and have we ever been secular? Mm. And the evidence doesn't, you know, if you look at certain evidence for secularity... Or
and by secularity, can I just confirm that you're talking about essentially non-religious? Is that kind of...
Yeah, like, for example, the secularisation thesis that religion is going to disappear.
Yeah. Mm.
Okay. So the evidence for that would be declining attendance in churches, etc.
Yeah.
Okay, now the historical evidence for that in Britain points to the 1960s. There was no necessarily huge decline in religious believing in this country until the 1960s. And there is a dramatic decline in the 1960s and the beginning of the 1970s. Though there is also, remember, the 1960s is the time when you got Vatican II, you got time of the whole kind of myth of God incarnate kind of. Mm. So you've got a lot of actual religion actually being discussed, but it's critical.
Sure.
And you know, what the demography shows is that decline in church attendance, for example, is only as dramatic as the same decline that goes on within political parties and trade unions. Mm. In other words, this is about not wanting to belong to institutions.
Okay.
It's not necessarily about religious believing. And so you've got a whole lot of people, Linda Woodhead, Grace Davey, Charles Taylor, who all talk about religious believing just continued. It just found different forms of objects
to associate itself
with.
I saw some really interesting study done, I think it was Pew Religious Forum or something in America, where people who even identified on their form as atheist then gave answers of a very religious nature to other questions involving belief in the supernatural and so on.
I think that's really interesting, because in fact that would tie in with, from about the mid-70s, what you've got is sometimes is called the rise of the new visibility of religion in the public sphere. It began there with the politicisation of Islam, and it then grew in terms of interest in Eastern religions, interest in neo-paganism, interest in all sorts of kind of spiritualities, for example, which then began to impact upon the European Survey of Values. So from the 1990s onwards, the European Survey of Values, particularly among young people, are charting the rise of belief in a God, but a God who is more imminent to the world, operative within the world, if you like, but also at the same time, a rise in the belief of life after death.
Yeah.
So it's no wonder then today, if you look at someone like videos like Lana Del Rey, Born to Die, or, you know, you'll find a number of these kind of themes of life after death actually coming up. I mean, Tree of Life, and another film quite recently done about
exactly
this.
Yeah.
So, in fact, this that tell me that there's a politics going on here to try and get us to believe in a secularism, which is an Enlightenment idea.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff, and just one of the many sort of aspects of the book, which plumbs all kinds of different routes and thoughts. Thank you very much for coming on the programme today.
Thank you.
It was nice to have Sue with us to begin with, but certainly nice also to have the chance and the space to have a bit of a conversation about other aspects of the book as well. If you want to get hold of it, it's Unbelievable, Why We Believe and Why We Don't, published by IB Taurus. Links, as I say, from today's show if you want to go to the web page. Do you sort of have any idea what might be next on the horizon now that you've sorted the mind-body issue?
I haven't sorted the mind-body. Goodness me. That would get me a Nobel Prize.
Any other projects, though, that we can look forward to while you're holding this post in the next few years?
I'm continuing to... at the moment, my attention is on another aspect of this, which is emotions and effect. And the relationship between that emotions, effect, and religious experience.
Right. All right. Well, who knows? We could be talking about that at some point down the line. But thank you very much for joining
me
on the programme today. And if you'd like to find out more, do go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Thank you for listening today. And in a moment's time, we're going to be hearing some of your feedback to the previous few weeks of programming. So do stick around here on Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, as ever, if you want to get in touch, you can find out how to do so by visiting the website. We've got all the links to the Twitter and Facebook account there. The email address, if you want to email in, is unbelievable@premier.org.uk. But the website with today's programme, more details on the guests featured, is at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there, of course, to the Unbelievable DVD and CD of this year's conference. And that will be hitting doormats very shortly, I'm assured. So if you've been waiting on tenterhooks for yours, it will be with you soon. Just takes a little bit of time, obviously, over the summer since the conference in July to get them all together and ready to dispatch. But we're looking forward to those all being with those who have already pre-ordered them very soon. If you want to pre-order yours as well, it's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable DVD. OK, let's go to some of your responses on email. And here's Tim Tiley in Bristol, who says, I thoroughly enjoyed your Unbelievable programme of last week, in which two philosophers were debating, and it was followed by the interview with Russell Stannard. What an excellent juxtaposition of the two very stimulating conversations. And the two philosophers in question last week on Unbelievable were, of course, Callum Miller, a young theist, and James Croft, who is a young atheist. They had a very interesting discussion on the particular argument from induction that Callum Miller was bringing, and lots of response to that. But just to conclude your thoughts here, Tim, you say, my own background was in science, and so it was going beyond my comfort zone when some of the more subtle ideas familiar to philosophers were being exchanged. I think I was also sometimes out of my depth, Tim. But however, your conversation with Professor Stannard then provided a very good balance, which I found picked up some points very well indeed. Yes, Russell Stannard was my guest on the Profile interview last week between 4 and 5. Thank you. Now, almost all the other emails in regard to last week's programme between Callum and James are from atheists, interestingly. And so I'm going to read out some of these now. And just to remind you, it was essentially on the theme of, is our universe more likely on atheism or theism? And Callum's contention was that the regularity we see in the universe and in other areas of our experience, moral experience and so on, makes a theistic world more likely, that this is the result of intention and design and everything else and not atheism. So lots of atheists responded. Michael says, on atheism, or more correctly, naturalism, the regularities of a materialistic universe is the only mechanism by which we would expect to arrive at the world we see. Regularity is essential to cosmology, physics at all levels, chemistry and genetics. There's no other way for us to have gotten here. On theism, or the realm of magical thinking, regularity is neither necessary nor expected. Specifically, according to Christian theism, God deals routinely in irregularities called miracles. Man was fashioned from dust. Animals talk. Angels appear. The world was inundated by waters. The sun was stopped in the sky. And a human woman was impregnated by a non-corporeal entity. And so on. Anyway, yes, I see what you mean there. But I'd say that, obviously,
Christians would say that miracles are, by definition, an intervention within the regular laws that otherwise govern the universe. This question of whether we could only be here if we existed in a regular universe, and so that's perfectly consistent with naturalism. Well, isn't that rather the whole point, is that the unlikeliness of this happening to turn out to be a universe with irregularity seems to push against that? I don't know. Okay, Justin in Pittsburgh says, once again, thank you for a very interesting discussion with Callum Miller and James Croft. Now, I don't think you are an atheist, Justin, so this is the one letter that got through that wasn't from an atheist. But overall, I appreciated the congenial discussion, civil attitudes. I did have a few concerns, though, regarding Callum's argument. Most importantly, Callum's argument from induction seemed to hinge upon the respective probabilities of theistic or atheistic accounts of a cosmological genesis. Yet when James pressed him, Callum appeared to be unable to offer specific criteria regarding the creation of such probabilities. If we can't give specific probabilities, e.g. 1 in a million, or even approximate probabilities, an order of magnitude double as likely, a million times more likely, then how can the conclusion be defended? Doesn't it therefore reduce to a simple assumption that it is more probable? Thank you for a great programme once again. I think Callum did try to sketch out an idea of what sort of probabilities he was talking about, though in the end I think it was more about the sort of the fact that we wouldn't expect to see this on an atheistic universe on the grounds that there are so many other potential universes that would not exhibit regularity. So I suppose in a sense it was a sort of one in a very small number, kind of one in a very big number, I should say, chance of us living in such a universe. But David Fox is the poet atheist who always writes in verse, and I'll try to do this justice, David. Justin and his friends are looking for evidence of their spirit god. They're looking into the universe, which seems a little odd. They gleefully talk of fine-tuning, while billions of stars and planets explode galore, and happily talk of human morals, which supposedly come from their god's law. Does the universe give us clues of a god only if you cherry-pick the good things in life and the Bible, and ignore all the bad things, which to me also seems very odd? Consider this: there is the sun, then God does exist. There is the moon, then God does exist. There is a meteorite that's going to crash into Earth and cause mass destruction and total death. Where is God? Says David Fox. Thank you, David. Darren, another atheist, says, ultimately, God is not a good explanation for anything because all the things said about God are made up and can't be demonstrated to be accurate. You can't just make up a definition or define something into existence and then claim that it is a good explanation for things. What evidence is the available body of facts or information indicating whether a belief or proposition is true or valid? The idea that evidence is what is surprising or not is completely wrong. Evidence has to be able to support the claims, and it has to be able to be demonstrated to be able to support the claims. A person's opinion about what is surprising or not is not evidence for a proposition. Okay, thank you very much. And so it carries on. Rob says, I had a chuckle in the Callum Miller versus James Croft show. At 23 minutes in, you inadvertently promoted a geocentric model of the solar system by stating that scientists can measure the orbit of the sun around the Earth, with a winky face. Yes, I probably did, Rob. I often don't know what I'm talking about on this show, to be honest. That said, Callum could not have picked a worse example than the rising and setting of the sun to make his case for God as a better explanation for regularity. If God can opt to set the mechanism in motion, he can just as well opt to stop it and prevent the sun from rising the next day, or for that matter, prevent the sun from setting, as is told in Joshua 10. Given the God hypothesis, it wouldn't be surprising at all if the sun would no longer rise or set, but given the non-theistic model of a rotating Earth and the law of inertia, it would be highly surprising. Well, again, just to push back on you there, Rob, in what sense is the model of a rotating Earth and the law of inertia a non-theistic model? It's perfectly consistent with atheism or theism, surely. The question is, would we expect to find ourselves in a universe with those kinds of regularities if there was no purpose or design behind it? And I think that's the whole point to boil it down into simple terms, of Callum's argument, that all of those aspects of our universe, the regularity, the laws of science, which we seem to have this extraordinary fertile ability to explore in a very mathematical way, the nature of the universe, doesn't seem to have any plausible reason that it would be like that on an atheistic universe. Only in a theistic universe would you expect to see such a thing. However, lots of people obviously disagreeing with that. And Derek's another one who says, you do a very good job of moderating the discussions, but a naturalistic worldview only allows a single way for sentient creatures to appear. There must be stable enough physics for chemistry to happen and stable enough chemistry for biology to happen, and a good long period of evolution so that embodied minds can develop. So regularities in the universe are exactly what is to be expected on a naturalistic worldview. Again, I have to go back to Derek. I just feel like you're begging the question there. I mean, yes, in a sense, you need all of that for life to develop. But those very things you mention, embodied minds can develop. I mean, there's so much complexity and apparent design, as far as I can tell, in that process for that to happen, that how you explain that on a naturalistic worldview is very difficult. Anyway, that's just my opinion. Thank you very much for getting in touch. Let's move to some other shows we've broadcast recently. Did a show on the Gaza conflict, Israel and Palestine. We had with us Salim Munaya of the charity Musalaha. He's a Arab-Palestinian Christian. And we had Steve Maltz on the other side of the discussion. He's a Messianic Jew, talking about, obviously, the crisis that's erupted in Gaza over the summer. And lots of you emailing on that as well, mainly Christians on this occasion. Here's Katie Mulligan, who says, "Greetings, Justin. The two-state solution is a mirage. It has no reality. It's simply hot air. There's only one state between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River, and that is Israel. The elimination of Palestinians, whether they be Muslims or Christians, is ongoing and will not cease until the Holy Land is a land purely for the Jews." Kevin. Okay. Uthmar says, "As a secular Jew, I don't really believe in the prophecies of the promised land. So my solution is have Israel buy out some land from a country where there's extra land, like Brazil or Australia or Canada, and establish a new land for the Jews. Of course, religious Jews won't agree with this. I'm just thinking it'll save tons of lives and also cost less than the defence budget. One more possible solution is to use land-filling technology and create an island in the middle of the ocean as new Israel. As long as we stay in Palestine, there's no alternative to bloodshed." Well, that's a creative idea, Uthmar. I can imagine there'd be one or two problems implementing something like that. Anne says, "It's upsetting about the people of Gaza, but Israel is a tiny country with a population of only 4 million, surrounded by vast Arab lands containing hundreds of millions of people who want to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. Three young lads were kidnapped and murdered just for being Jewish, and Israel's towns are constantly hit by Hamas's rockets. Yet, when the Israelis strike back, they're condemned. If Hamas left Israel alone, then presumably Israel would leave them alone. The state of Israel occupies a tiny fraction of what was a huge area of Judea. MPs should stop feeling sympathy for terrorists and support the minority. Until the wall was built by Israel, Christian groups largely had to stop visiting Israel because of the terrorist bombs hitting Israel's buses, etc. I feel very sorry for the Israelis." And Joyce says, "Thanks for the programme. I was concerned that the impression that I felt Salim Munaya gave was that the Palestinians were the indigenous people in the land, and the Jews had come in from outside, taken over and pushed them out. If there is to be progress, then both sides have to be completely honest about what has happened in the past and what is happening now. From what I have tried to ascertain, there have been Jews and Arabs living in the land who can trace back their roots to biblical times. It's not only Jews who have migrated to Israel over the past 100 years, but also great numbers of Arabs have migrated there from other Arab countries in the past century. I understand that the programme was trying to look forward to ways that reconciliation can be achieved rather than dwelling in the past, but I believe that truth about the past and present is important and should be acknowledged and crystal clear," says Joyce. Okay, Amy Breeds, I don't know if I'm pronouncing your surname correctly, but you're in the New York City area, says, "I usually enjoy your broadcast, but the conversation between Salim and Steve was frustrating and annoying. Munaya clearly hogged the airtime. He interrupted and corrected Maltz more than one, and when he was interrupted, he said, 'Let me finish, ugh.' I would have liked to hear much more from Steve Maltz, who sadly wasn't up to the task of debating the likes of Munaya. However, I did enjoy the discussion about the necessity of love and relationship, etc. All of that was excellent. I'm a Christian Zionist and and not ashamed to say so. Munaya mentioned being weary of certain criticisms of his theology, such as its spiritualization of the land promise and unfulfilled prophecy for ethnic Israel. Well, I'm weary of his eisegesis. Unfortunately, he wasn't soundly refuted on your programme. I'd love to hear Salim Munaya debate Michael Brown. Now, that would be an equal match, so to speak. All right, thank you very much. Jay says, I enjoy the premise of addressing current world issues and how we should address them from a Christian perspective. I especially enjoyed the one on poverty. Now, I don't know if illegal immigration is something that resonates in England at all, but being an American, living in Texas, it's something we're faced with daily, and it's something I've struggled with internally, about how to love those coming here illegally, but at the same time wanting our laws to be upheld, believing that it's ultimately hurting our nation economically for these citizens of other countries to be coming here illegally. Anyway, I'd love to hear a Christian or Christian non-Christian debate about that. Well, certainly, Jay, immigration is certainly a political issue over here in the UK as well. In fact, probably one of the issues that much of the political election next year will be based around, as certain parties such as UKIP over here in the UK, the United Kingdom Independence Party, have certainly staked their particular claims on issues around immigration and levels of foreigners entering the country and that kind of thing. So certainly something we might well address at some point down the line. Thank you very much. Have we got time for one more? Let's do Tim talking about economics and the poor. This was Wayne Grudem on the show a few weeks ago in discussion about his book on the poverty of nations. I'm really glad you took up the topic. It may have been different from your usual fare, but the topic was entirely appropriate. I look forward to reading Wayne Grudem's book. He did say he and his co-author were unaware of any other book from a Christian perspective that dealt with the issue of overcoming poverty at a national level. But the principles he expressed are very similar to what Jay Richards expounds in his book Money, Greed and God: Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem. Richards wrote this book as part of his work at the Acton Institute, which is named after your own Lord Acton, who came up with the famous dictum, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I teach in the economics department at a Japanese university and give a seminar on ethics and economics using this book as a basis. Just as Wayne Grudem stated, the principles of private property rights and the rule of law are critical in giving opportunity to the poor to begin to produce wealth. However, what exactly constitutes the rule of law and how those laws are determined is where things get more complicated. If the version of the golden rule that dictators typically follow, namely, he who has the gold makes the rules, is used, then of course the rule of law doesn't result in that society lifting itself out of poverty. Instead, it must be based on the version that Christ taught: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So not only must the rules be followed in order for people to be free to create wealth and keep the fruits of their labours, those rules must also be fair and appropriate to the situation of the poor. Exactly how to do that is where a lot of discussion and debate is necessary. I look forward to similar great programmes in the future. Thank you, Tim, in Japan, for emailing in. Thank you, everyone who's been in touch with Unbelievable. Thank you for listening today, and I hope you can join me again at the same time next week here on the show that aims to get you thinking. Let me tell you what's coming up.
You're unbelievable.
We're going to be hearing from Nick Spencer of the think tank Theos. He's got a new book out. It's called Atheist: The Origin of the Species, looking at the history of atheism and some of its modern forms. Atheist philosopher and writer Julian Baggini is going to be here to interact with him, we hope. So do come again at the same time next week. For now, thank you for listening to this week's Unbelievable. And do stay tuned if you're listening in this Saturday afternoon as Lucinda van der Hart speaks to mum and megachurch leader Charlotte Gamble in The Profile next.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card. The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus Card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.